It's good. Can't tell you how good it is to be back here at Govardhan Eco Village and with all of you. I was somehow expecting to talk to a class, so I will just talk with all of you. And I've given many talks in my life, and I always figure those who show up are exactly the people who should be there. So I'm glad to see these shining faces here this morning. I've been traveling a lot and preparing a lot for travels, and my mind has been kind of whirling in so many directions. But I thought that today I would just share with you some of the thoughts I've been having about bhakti. And the theme, I suppose, that I would like to speak on this morning is the boldness of bhakti. The boldness of bhakti. I want to begin with a verse that is from, I'm sure it's an ashtakam that you know, the Madhura Ashtakam. Adharam madharam vadanam madharam nayanam madharam hasitam madharam hridayam madhuram gamanam madhuram madhuradhipate akhilam madhuram. His lips are sweet, his face is sweet, his eyes are sweet, his smile is sweet, his heart is sweet, and his movements are sweet. Everything is sweet about the Lord of sweetness. Whose lips are we talking about here? These are the lips of Parabrahman. These are the lips of the ultimate. These are the lips of the unlimited. These are the lips of the all-powerful creator of the universe. And here we're singing about his lips and a desire to attain the nectar from those lips even. What boldness of this. What boldness is it to presume that one might be a friend of the Supreme? What boldness is it to assume that one might be an elder of the Supreme or a lover of the Supreme to attain the nectar of those lips? What kind of boldness is this that we are looking at here? What I would like to do is explore some of the stories from the Bhagavad and to think about them a bit. And I want to begin with a story that I'm sure you're all very familiar with. Ignorance in the form of a hideous child-killing demon approaches Gokul and assumes the guise of a beautiful young woman and works her way into the house of Yashoda Maya, and works her way into that house to the degree that she is allowed to suckle this new sweet baby at her breast. And we know that breast has been smeared with poison, and we know exactly why. And she takes that tender child to her breast and begins to suckle it. But something strange starts happening to her. And this young child begins to suck the very life from her. And she becomes concerned and yet can't detach him from her body. And she runs outside screaming and howling in pain. And she turns into her huge ogre form and still can't get rid of this child and crashes to the earth dead. And the Brijbasis come rushing out of their homes hearing this commotion and come upon the scene where they see this small, tender, vulnerable baby on the breast of this hideous demon, Putana. In his commentary on the Bhagavad Puran, the Subodhini, Sri Vallabhacharya reads this story with Putana being an ignorance that keeps the Brajbasis, keeps Bhaktas from understanding the true nature of reality, who we are, who Krishna is ultimately. So in killing Putana, Krishna is removing that ignorance from the Bhaktas, from the Brajbasis in the story specifically. But something strange happens when the villagers of Gokul burn the body of this hideous demon Putana to get rid of her. There is a sweet fragrance that remains in the air after burning her body. And Vallabhacharya interprets that sweet fragrance as a remainder of ignorance. Another strange thing here, because what this is saying is that avidya, ignorance, is a pramana. It's really only in the Bhagavad Krishna Bhakti traditions of Braj that we find this strange incident where ignorance itself can be a pramana, a means of attaining the prameya, the very divine object of our quests. Ignorance is that, a very special kind of pramana for connecting one in a deep relationship with Krishna. So I want to enter with that notion into another story that I'm sure you're familiar with. And here the setting has Krishna a bit older. And he's old enough now that his parents decide to let him go out with the other boys to herd the cows in the forest. But Nanda Baba and Yashoda Maya are concerned enough that they ask Krishna's elder brother, Balaram, to watch out for his brother, to take care of him and make sure that he doesn't get in trouble or is not harmed in any way. So when they're out, Balaram is keeping a good eye on Krishna. And for some reason, Krishna looks at him and he reaches down and he takes a handful of dirt and he pops some of it into his mouth. And Balaram is stunned and he's saying, "Why are you doing that? That is really unhealthy. Don't do that anymore." And Krishna, being the naughty boy he is, reaches down for another handful of dirt and pops that into his mouth. And at this point, Balaram says, "Okay, forget it. I'm telling Mom. I'm not going to deal with you." So he says, "Yashoda Maya, Krishna is eating dirt." And Yashoda responds by calling Krishna to her, "Come on over here. Get over here now." And Krishna comes up, "Yes, Ma." And she says, "Open your mouth so I can see." First she says, "Balaram, your brother says that you're eating dirt. Is that true?" And Krishna says, "Oh no, Ma, I wouldn't do that." He says, "I don't believe you. Open your mouth so I can see for myself." So this small child of Yashoda opens his tiny mouth and she peers inside to see if there's any dirt. And you know the story. She sees that there's much, 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 much more than dirt in his mouth, for she sees the entire universe inside the mouth of her tiny child. And at that point, her vatsalya bhav, that motherly love for this child, is shattered in that moment. And she responds with fear, looking inside that mouth and understanding in a strange way who Krishna is. There's a phrase that I hear in Braj, I certainly hear it in Pushtimargiya circles, Mahatma Gyan Purvak, Dridha Sneha, that I think there's many ways of characterizing bhakti, But it's one useful way for me to think about bhakti. Mahatma Gyan Purvak Drida Sneha. That is, it is a, sneha here means a highest form of love. It is Drida Sneha. It is a firm love. It is a mature love, a fully blown love. But that is full of Mahatma Gyan, an awareness of the ultimate nature of reality, of the ultimate nature of Krishna. And this sort of story, we're seeing Yashoda coming into an awareness of that Mahatma Gyan, the immensity of Krishna, the infinity of Krishna. This small boy is that reality. And as I say, her motherly love for this small child is shattered. And she begins to apologize. Oh, if I would have only known who you really were, I wouldn't have yelled at you. I wouldn't have spanked you when you're naughty. I wouldn't have put you to bed without eating. I wouldn't have done any of that. But of course, she wouldn't have held him tenderly on her lap either. So Krishna then, the Bhagavad says, spun his web of Maya over her once again, so that she could see him as her small child and return to that deep, loving connection with Krishna in that form as she did before. So here is an example of that Mother Yashoda's love for Krishna is dependent upon a kind of ignorance, this special kind of ignorance that is left over from burning the body of that massive ignorance that took the form of the demon Putana. But this love is a love that is also assumes a knowledge. So in that story, we're seeing two plays coming together, one of the infinity of Krishna and one of a particular adorable form of Krishna. And both forms become so important for developing that deep, deep love of Krishna that bhakti is all about. And since I understand that there's a celebration of Gita Jayanti going on, I think that the Bhagavad Gita, in many ways, does such a superb job of getting at this. And it's this play of the revelation of the infinite and the concealment of the infinite that is going on in so many of the leelas that we encounter in Srimad Bhagavatam. The determination, that loving determination of Yashoda, who attempts to tie up, to bind up the infinite when it is naughty. Another story where Yashoda is trying to tie Krishna up so he doesn't get in trouble. But you know this story, the rope is too short. And so she gets another rope and ties onto that, and that turns out to be too short. And another rope, and that's too short. How does one tie up the infinite in any way? And yet her motherly love somehow is involved with that. And we know that Krishna, out of his act of grace, as the infinite assumes that finite and allows her to bind him with a rope. That's that play of the infinite and the seeming finite. I was going to say finite, but it's a seeming finite that is played out here. And to me, there's a way of reading the Bhagavad Gita as a large narrative, which is doing precisely this. Chapter 2 begins with, or let me jump just briefly to the terminology of chapter 8. It's in chapter 7 that Krishna promises to reveal to Arjuna his a complete understanding of who he is. And so things really shift there. And in chapter 8, it begins with answers to the questions, really, what is the Adibhuta, what is the Adhyatma, and what is the Adidaiva? These are terminologies that become so important in many of the theological texts that we find in the Braj Vaishnava traditions. The Adibhuta is defined with this term kshara. So the Adibhuta dimension of Krishna is, this is a tradition where the world is not rejected as somehow unreal. It's the dimension of the very world itself of multiple forms, the forms that are kshara, that are ever changing, not stable in some sense. The play is one of motion. And the second level dimension of this reality, the adhyatma, we see that word atma embedded in that. So this is the akshara. The Gita defines the adhyatmic reality with the word akshara. Akshara Brahman is the unchanging, unmanifest, voidal, so to speak, one. And then there's a third dimension that becomes so important in the Bhagavad Gita, the Adidaiva dimension, defined very briefly at the beginning of chapter 8 with the word Purusha, a word that goes back clear back to the Purusha Sukta, defining the complex nature of Bhagavan. And in the 15th chapter, Purushottama is defined as an embracing of the reality of the kshara, of the adibhuta reality, and the adhyatmic akshara reality, the changing, the unchanging, the manifest and the unmanifest, the one and the many, embracing, somehow encompassing those, and yet transcending them into a realm that bhakti so depends upon. So the narrative that is laid out in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it tells a progression, really, of those three dimensions. Where to begin with the story of Bhagavad Gita? But let's take it, and in some sense, Arjuna knows that Krishna is not an ordinary being. But he forgets that too. Forgetfulness seems to be part of human mental nature. And so Krishna begins teaching him about, chapter 2 is really about jnana. And jnana in Vedantic traditions means teaching about the nature of ultimate reality, as well as the nature of our true self, the Atma. So the self is defined in that way that it is unborn, undying, smaller than the smallest, larger than the largest. Again, sure, you know all this well. But that jnana reality begins to open Arjuna's mind to a reality that he had somehow overlooked in the stuck depression that we find him in the beginning of the Gita. Arjuna begins to get that. He begins to get that there's something so much more to Krishna than simply this form of his buddy, friend that he knows, he thinks well. And so he asks Krishna in the 11th chapter, which is such a dynamic chapter, to reveal this form beyond to him. To reveal what the text ultimately defines then is the Akshara Brahman reality. So Krishna responds by giving Arjuna a special eye to see that dimension of reality. And in effect, Krishna takes off his mask, the mask of that limited personal form that Arjuna is so attached to. And behind the mask then reveals an infinity of forms. Gita says that it's an infinity of forms present ekastha in one point. How do we begin to conceive what that might be? What is this text talking about? if you could see everything simultaneously in one point, what would you actually see? And I might suggest that you would see absolutely nothing. Right now, what color is the color of light between my hands? And it's what scientists call white light. We can't see white light. White light contains all colors, in theory. And you all know that if I had a prism, I could take that white light and split it out into the vast array of rainbow colors, into specific colors, so now I could identify that's red light, that's blue light, that's green light, etc. So it's that. It's a coming together of the infinity into a single point. This is what Krishna is revealing to Arjuna. And Arjuna says, now I understand. So there's a gain of a consciousness of a deep reality of who Krishna is. And the term Akshara Brahman is used there then in the Gita to identify that reality. For the Mayavadi schools, represented by a figure like Shankara, you can close the book and go home at this point. It's all over. You've achieved Akshara Brahman, the very goal of all practice. But that's not where bhakti ends. This is where jnana is a springboard into bhakti, I think the Gita is telling us. Because Arjuna begins to react with emotionality in some sense. And he's saying there's no possibility of orientation. If you were out in outer space, because if we mixed all colors, I was using a kind of light image, but if we used opaque colors, if we mix all colors together, you know that you get black. Now let's switch into a different, you're in outer space, maybe there's no stars and you're just floating, there's no up, down, east, west, there's no orientation at all. It says there's no orientation possible. Ultimately there's no connection possible, there's no love possible, there's nothing really possible when it's all together in such a fashion. And so Arjuna then says, this is too much. I'm being overwhelmed. There's something that's not working here. And he requests Krishna to return to a particular form. A particular form that he knows well. Return to that form that I know that has allowed my deep connection with you. And the Gita makes it clear that there's always lots of noise around here. The sound of Akshara Brahman in some form. Yeah, where was I? So Arjuna is requesting Krishna to return to that his friend, that form he knows so well. And I was saying that the Gita says that Krishna teaches Arjuna because of their friendship. So there was a friendship, but a friendship that in a sense was quite fragile to the revelation of the infinity of Krishna, that vastness of Akshara Brahman. But we know that Krishna then does return to a form so that Arjuna is able once again to connect with him in a deep way. But it's not just any form. It is called the Somya Manusha Rupa in the Gita. Somya is probably most literally translated as a gentle form. But I think it's also a familiar form. It's a form that allows deep, deep connectivity. Now, Krishna has in effect put his mask back on. This is the mask of a kind of ignorance that is now covering over that vastness that is there in the understanding of Mahatma Gyan. So Arjuna returns to a kind of a love, but it's a kind of a love now that is increased in its strength. Because like Yashoda, behind her, the form of Krishna as her child, which is the foremost form for her in her deep relationship of Vatsalya Bhav with child Krishna. But now behind that, sort of hidden, it's there, but it's covered by this sweet ignorance that allows the deep connectivity with a particular form. The Gita uses the term swakam rupam. I was a short-term svarup. And so I think what I'm talking about here also pertains to, well, let me define the term swarup in the way that I see it. Swarup has a double meaning. Its literal translation is own form. But it has a double meaning in this sense. It's Krishna's own form. This isn't some symbol of Krishna. This is not some distant representation. It is Krishna fully present in the swarup. So it is Krishna's own form. But from the devotee's perspective, from Arjuna's perspective in this story, it's his own form. It's the form that Krishna came to him in. And this is not the only form that Krishna comes to. There's many, many, many different forms. In fact, it is said that the disposition of the bhakta determines the form that Krishna takes. One of my favorite verses in the Bhagavad Gita is 7:21. Yo, yo, yam, yam, tanu bhakta. What a great sound. Yo, yo, yam, yam, tanu bhakta. That Krishna assumes the form that the devotee worships him and responds to the devotee in that way. So Krishna is ever shape-shifting, depending upon the particular bhav, the particular love of a devotee. For Arjuna, this was his friend, Krishna. For others, it could be Krishna as a child. Krishna as, when Krishna comes in finally into the arena in Mathura to deal with Kamsa, I'm sure you're familiar with that text, and you know that Krishna is seen. He is one and yet many simultaneously. He's seen differently by the different bhaktas, the brajbasis that are gathered there, depending upon their bhav. So he's seen as a child by his parents, he's seen as a buddy to his fellow gopas. He's seen as a beloved to the gopis, and so that's what I'm seeing in the sense of the swarup that is there. So a return, a putting on of the mask, and that this now is that dridha sneha, one that is understanding the Mahatma Gyan nature of Bhagavan. And yet that is concealed with this sweet form of ignorance, this pramana, this context in which ignorance becomes a pramana, very unusual in philosophical systems within Hinduism, where ignorance is functioning as a pramana. That special ignorance that allows the deep sambandha, the deep connective relationship with Paramatma, now in some swarup. And I think that this is in many ways the key to one key, there's no single key, one key to understanding seva swarup seva, or deity worship. Here we're blessed with these beautiful, gorgeous swarups in this temple. These are swarups in the sense, fully present forms. And there are those who live in this community that must feel very attached. These are forms that have come to us, that we develop close relationships with. And that, I think, is the key to understanding. There's a lot of misunderstanding of Murti Puja, Swarup Seva, even within India, let alone outside of India. It's seen as, oh, worshiping some particular form, particular stone, particular whatever it might be. But it is worshiping a particular form. But it's worshiping a particular form with the awareness that that particular form is non-different from that which is radically beyond all particularity. So here is that Mahatmigyan Purava, Dhrida Sneha, that covering with ignorance that allows this. This is that boldness in bhakti that allows one to approach the all-powerful, infinite Param Brahman in a very personal relationship. And that's what bhakti really finally is all about, is that deep, loving connection with Brahman in a particular form. So I suppose I just want to encourage all you to move forward in your devotional life with a boldness of treating Param Brahman as a child, as a friend, as a lover, whatever the case may be. There's a boldness there, a presumption there, that in many senses is wildly misunderstood. In the face of the infinite, in the face of the all-powerful cosmic one, it's understandable that many people shrink back with a kind of a fear. But bhaktas move forward toward that in the pursuit of a deep connective relationship. So I'm hoping that going over stories with you that must be quite familiar to you, and thinking about the connection between some of those stories and even what is going on in the Bhagavad Gita has been useful in ways to you. So we've got time left. I would love to hear questions related to this that you might have. Sure. And yeah, maybe passing with a mic. My hearing is not great at all, by the way, so I would appreciate the mic also for you.
Thank you so much, Prem Das Prabhu. First, I would really like to appreciate a few points that you mentioned. First thing, how you presented this divine or transcendental type of ignorance, which makes our connection with Krishna, or is it instrumental or in making our connection with Krishna, that I really appreciate. Secondly, the point you mentioned about Swakam Rupam, it's not just Krishna's own form, it is the devotee's worshipable form, therefore it's Swakam Rupam. And that was really illuminating. And also how you mentioned that if whole of the knowledge, the Mahatmya, is revealed in simultaneously, then it more than connection, it will lead to confusion. Where how should I relate to this now? The entire Vishwarup is shown in Krishna's form. So that's third thing I really appreciate from your class. And how we should be bold enough to move towards Krishna in one particular relationship that we are aspiring for. And that is bhakti in a very succinct and beautiful manner you mentioned, which I really appreciate. My question now, may I ask my question? So first, when we try to introduce Krishna to the audience, which may be varied, so it's like when I talk to people about Krishna, is it Like first I need to introduce to them that Krishna is supreme or he is God and like he is Aishwarya Gyan. And then at a particular, for a particular audience, I may have to present, now you have to forget that Krishna is God and Krishna is, you may have to forget that Krishna is beyond the entire existence and all, and but focus on your connection with Krishna. So in a mixed audience, what should be the, what approach is good? Like some of them may require to know that Krishna is supreme and he is behind all the existence, and some of the audience may want to hear that, oh, how my connection with Krishna has to have the prominence over his cosmic relationship. Like, so that's my question.
Yeah, well, that's a great question, a complicated context to really deal with in some sense. So any teaching environment, any teacher faces that with a general audience in ways. Certainly in my own teaching experience, that's always challenging, to have a classroom of students who come with such different backgrounds, different expectations. How does one teach to a group? And there's no easy solution to that, and I don't want to claim that I have some right answer in that. I can just maybe struggle with you in thinking about it a bit. And it's, first, I think you got a good start. It's understanding the multiplicity of the audience, and so that they are individuals. There's no such thing as some generic audience. It's all the same. How do you reach all people? And so I think it's giving everyone something in that, and showing that those are connected. So for those, I mean, the kind of the spectrum, and I think even my own relationship, say, in thinking about Krishna, when I think about, sometimes I like to start with a definition of Krishna as Vasudevaha Sarvam, such a nice, concise way of putting that Krishna is the totality of all reality in some sense, right? So but that's that kind of vast notion that's going to probably be satisfying, and at times for me personally, satisfying way of thinking about Krishna. But then I was talking with Mohan Vilas Das Prabhuji yesterday about how one of my own attractions to Krishna is the fact that he's always smiling. I was telling him a story of, I met a man, a Vaishnava teacher, who we were at a festival, and it was just a grand festival. And I love festivals where Krishna is being celebrated and everyone is happy. I was very happy and just feeling the bhav, so to speak, and really in that deep mood. And so I asked him, how can we just stay in this mood all the time? And you know, I'm eager for this. I'm impatient. I want it all the time. And he says, well, you know, it's not really, that's not the way it works, that there's a rhythm to this. And it's kind of the rhythm of some yog viyog and separation and union. And so sometimes it's there and sometimes festivals aren't. And that's just the way it works. It works in waves. But he said something else that really stuck with me. And that is, he said, but if there's something you want to do, he said that we worship a God who is always smiling, so we too should always be smiling. And to put on a smile does actually affect a sweet bhav in some sense. And it's Krishna always has a smile. He's always smiling. When he's killing demons, he's smiling. When he's holding Mount Govardhan, he's smiling. The Bhagavad uses the term in those contexts, lilaya, a lot. He does it playfully. So I think of just that lovable, approachable, joyful, smiling Krishna, which is quite different then from Vasudevaha Sarva. Not different, but it's a different flavor. And so it would speak to different folks. And so how to talk about, I think there's the only way really finally to talk about Krishna is in a very complex way. He is shape-shifting. you can never pin him down. Leela is such a brilliant way of looking at reality that it's highly unpredictable. So there's no singular way of talking about it. And I think it's somehow bringing in that complex, shape-shifting, ever-changing, all-encompassing nature. How does one do that? I can say those words, but that's challenging in ways. So, but that's what even a story like the story of Krishna eating dirt is a story that has both of those dimensions in there and provides an occasion then to talk about the nature of Krishna in that complex way. So Bhagavad has such fantastic stories to work with. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu. Prabhu, I just had this question. In your presentation of Krishna Bhakti to students and to broader society, what have you found to be the most biggest resistance to a form, to accepting a personal form compared to what all other world religions present? So what challenge or what resistance comes up when you present bhakti in your rich experience of dealing with students in society?
Right. Well, my audience of teaching is to American students for the most part. And I think the most difficult feature of Hinduism for them, just because the United States is becoming more and more diversified, so we see all religions are present there. Nonetheless, the predominant religion that I think defines the culture is Protestant Christianity. And Protestant Christianity completely rejects visible form of God, right? And so that Mohanji and I were talking about this yesterday a bit, but some of the Protestant theologians, such as John Calvin, who was so influential in shaping Christian Protestant traditions, says in his works that any worship of a visible form of God is idolatry. And even God is not present in nature, and one could go on with this. So that coming from that, even American Catholicism, which in Europe is much more engaged with images and doesn't really have to live in that culture, is affected by that. So that the most challenging dimension in Hinduism for my students probably is what I would call Murti Puja. And I use the Bhagavad Gita in a sense, and ideas that are in there to introduce this to them. And I think in the end, they're very fascinated with that, because that the Western world that has really rejected any notion of sacrality in nature have come to understand the extreme limitations in that because of the environmental crisis that we're in today. So there's a deep questioning about, I think we're increasingly realizing we got a lot wrong. So traditions where we know in Hinduism that murtis can be trees, they can be rivers, they can be mountains, they can be swaroops in mandirs, they can be swaroops in home shrines. There's a rich, rich world. Ultimately, if that statement's Vasudevaha Sarvam does include the jagat. So in the Vaishnava traditions, the jagat is not rejected as somehow an illusory reality that needs to be avoided, but rather there's a recognition that it is a dimension of Krishna. So I think that these dimensions, although they're hard, that they are challenging. And I, in a month, am going to be on a ship and sailing around with students, and our first stop is in India, and I plan to take them into Hindu temples and really work with this with them. And so I think that it's that challenging element. It's so much of, but this, the, this relational, personal aspect of these traditions, I think, in an embodied way, in especially interaction with Swaroops and your beautiful pujas of Giriraj or and the Sringars, I think that ultimately, I'm excited to bring them into that. So I just think that's a challenge element. And I'm aware that increasingly this is a challenging element within Hinduism itself. There are those who reject the notion that form can be an ultimate presence of, let me use the general word, praman. Yeah. I mean, I could go on speaking of, I think, some of those challenges, but I don't want to go on too long with an answer to each question. I want to make sure that if there are other questions, you have an opportunity. Because I find your questions, how what I have said affects you or what you're left with, to me is useful in ways. But
Hare Krishna. If I could ask, this one just intrigued me. I saw your book translation and of Srila Rupa Goswami. So it's a kind of personal question. How did you get intrigued or interested in the works of Srila Rupa Goswami? That was my curiosity.
Yeah. Well, in some sense, it happened somewhat accidentally, but then what's accidentally? By the time I went on to graduate school to study religion seriously enough to get a PhD in it and go on to teach in it, I had been attracted to North Indian Krishna Bhakti traditions through work in college. Reading Bhagavad Gita and reading, I read the Upanishads and I was just dazzled by those texts to begin with and the Gita. And through a study of Krishna artwork and all, I knew about Krishna Bhakti traditions and was interested enough in them that I knew that for my special work that I wanted to work in North Indian Bhakti traditions, but I didn't really know specifically what that would look like. And I went to one of my advisors. I was a student at the University of Chicago, and one of my advisors was Edward Dimmock, who was one of the first Western scholars to seriously study Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And he studied with Bengali scholars primarily before that. He also introduced the study of Bengali in the U.S. First. He was the first really to do that. And he was a marvelous human being. And I had the good fortune of having him as one of my professors. So when it came time for me to begin to focus my studies in a particular area to write a dissertation, I went to him and for his advice. And he asked me what I was interested in. I said that by this point in my life, I'd studied all religious traditions. And I told him I was really dazzled by the descriptions of sacred realities in different religious traditions. But the question that I was left with was, how does one actually enter into and participate in a particular religious reality? And in addition to that, I said I had a great interest in theater. And I just think theater is a very powerful human experience, both as the experience of the actors as well as the audience. And so I expressed some of this to him. And at that time, he spun around in his chair and put his fingers on the greatest writing device of the time, which was an Olivetti electric typewriter, and he typed out a list of books, and one of them was Bhaktira Samhita Sindhu, and he thought that I should look at that with my interests. And at that time, the only English translation of the text available was a quarter of it by Bon Maharaj, the scholar who lived in Vrindavan. And so I read that, and that had enough in it that I was deeply, deeply intrigued, because it introduced me to the concept of Raganuga Bhakti Sadhana. And so it was a pursuit of a deep understanding of Raganuga Bhakti Sadhana that led me to reading that text more seriously and working with that text. And I think Ed Dimmock, my professor, was really right that text tells it, because it's really talking about how does one enter in deeply into the Leela, and it's by following the Brajbasis, and particularly the gopis or the gurus of that in ways, and just laying out that. So that became my first project in ways. And my dissertation first book was a study of Raganuga Bhakti Sadhana, and eventually I translated Bhakti Rasam to Sindhu. And now there are other translations of it out there, but yeah. So I guess that's what led me to it, was certain interests, and then just really be taken by that world. And it was that text that took me to Vrindavan for the first time, because I went to Vrindavan to read Bhakti Rasam to Sindhu, and in the place it was written, and understand something of the culture that it helped produce at the time with the Vrindavan Goswamis and all. And I simply went as a textualist and had, just through, I suppose, somehow good graces and good fortune, ended up living in the Radharaman Ghera and experienced a Hindu mandir, which was Radharaman mandir, and Radharaman, what an amazing place to end up in, which led me into the world of so much of Hindu practice, and particularly Krishna Bhakti traditions. And yeah, and the more I got into it, the more I got into it. And I say that somehow I was deeply seduced into that world. And my first experience in coming to Vrindavan was extremely alienating, I was experiencing culture shock. I had no idea where I was. A year later, I was wiping tears away as I was preparing to leave. Yeah. So somehow, I lost my heart in Vrindavan.
May I request you to share what you are telling Thomas Aquinas shares about the restless nature, and that restlessness ultimately being fulfilled? That would be a perfect cherry on top of today's beautiful presentation.
Yeah, I was quoting a line from one of the early church fathers in Christianity, Augustine, who said, "You made us for yourselves, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." And that's an idea that is expressed so deeply in our Krishna Bhakti traditions of Braj, is that in some sense the struggle is searching deeply for that object that will satisfy us. And we're told today, all you have to do is turn on a television and you're told what that is, right? If you just get this one thing, you'll be satisfied. If you just get this one thing. But we know that doesn't work. And so it's following our disappointment from one disappointment to another till we come to the true vishaya of our desire. And I think desire gets a bad rap in a lot of traditions. And desire is very tricky. It can take you down bad paths, the wrong paths. But I think there's something very tender about the nature of desire, because I think it finally is what is leading us to Bhagavan and that deep relationship. So I think that's what Augustine is saying, is that this concept of the bija bhav being embedded in our very souls, taking us back, to that connection with the ultimate. And that's that deep sense of Leela. One of the texts in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad that I just continually stay attracted to is Brihadaranyaka 1.4, which says, in the beginning there's the one, called Brahman, Atma, Purush, called by many names, there's the one. But that one was lonely and bored. And so out of that sense of boredom, it split itself into a multiplicity to have the joy of playing with itself. We are that split off particle, so to speak. And the human purpose ultimately is to play with Bhagavan. But we get distracted and all sorts of things and forget what the ultimate play is. That loving, playful union to dance with Bhagavan, that's what it's ultimately about. So it's coming, it's somehow letting that bija bhav lead us on. And it's okay. In some sense, we all stumble, we all fall, we get stuck on all sorts of crazy objects and fascinations. But I think it's just continuing going on. And so many of you here, you're like already so incredibly fortunate to be living in a community where this is assumed. I find myself so desperately eager for satsang, and that's why I enjoy coming to places like this. You live in a community where you've already figured out much of this, many of you, in your life journeys. But just to continue on then in that development, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O Lord. That's expressed in Gaudiya Vaishnava literature everywhere. Rupa Goswami would say that the ultimate vishaya of our kam is Krishna, right? So clearly. Yeah. Well, if there's no more questions, we're after 9. And thank you so much for all coming and listening to me share some of the confusion and insights of my mind. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we are so happy and honored to have Prem Dasji and his good wife, Sandy, so leaving us mesmerized with this presentation of understanding the mellows of Braj Bhakti through academic Vaishnav scholarship. So, Prabhu is... This is part of creation of Vrindavan, so we have begun to love it. Prabhu is such an example of a beautiful synchronicity of a Brajvasi and an academic American scholar. So it is very enchanting for us to see our own tradition through your eyes. So we are very grateful and honored to have you here, and we would like to thank Prabhu and Mataji by chanting out loud, Hari Bol. His interests are very much aligned to what we here at Govardhan Eco Village are trying to accomplish, as he has authored books on Raganuga Bhakti, The 12 Forests of Vrindavan, and his latest book is on understanding climate change through religious life ways. So, I mean, that's exactly what we're doing here, Braj Bhakti, sustainability. So, thank you very much once again.